you come in, come on down. Patrick does not bite. Been around a lot. Good morning, interpreters. I love how I say good morning, interpreters, and everybody here says good morning. Headsets for anyone. Remember, it's not just about you speaking another language. It's about you understanding someone else's. So headsets are in the back. Unless everybody understands Russian and Arabic, you mightn't want to get them. I know I'm failing miserably in those two languages as hard as I try. Spanish as well. So headsets are that thing you want to pick up on your way in the door. So I'll just patter on just a little bit, and I know you'll be right back. So Wednesday, today we have, at the end of the day, another one of our accountability sessions. So if you have been studying, if you've been not able to attend, this afternoon is your best time to spend a couple hours with the working groups and the experts who have been working on this for months and hoping to come to a grand conclusion for all of us at this meeting. So today is a good day for that. We have, I know, an IDN session today. Nabil, you are presenting today. If Nabil has come here. 1 p.m. So in support of Nabil's presentation as well, if you haven't had yourself signed up to another session, I know I'm going to try to be there at one, so I'm in support of our alumni, another session. This morning, we are going to start off the morning with Patrick Fahlstrom, who is the chair for the Security Stability Advisory Committee. We have the possibility there to my people who would love some free time today. We have the possibility of not being here after this. We had one presenter last night had to cancel, and another one is not sure because of the workload. So, you know, that's kind of a win. It's all right. We'll see how that goes. But for right now, Patrick, good morning. It's yours.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. So I heard that you are talking a little bit about the IANA transition issues. I have some good news. As you know, the transition itself is done by a group called ICG, which I also happen to be a co-chair of, requested from the names, numbers, and the protocol parameter operation communities to come up with the proposals that we would compile into the solution for how to continue to run IANA. We have not met with you in ICG, and that just because our work is going quite smoothly. We actually had an open session Monday when we, here in the auditorium, where anyone could ask questions if they wanted. We got zero questions, believe it or not. So we closed out the 5 minutes, so people got 55 minutes back. But then the people dealing with accountability, which I have no idea, honestly, why they are talking so much about accountability, because the IANA transition is not much accountability at all. People are talking about what they're unhappy with ICANN, which is a completely different thing. So to some degree, I'm a little bit irritated over that group not really keeping to their stay into their charter. But on the other hand, the chairs of that, they're doing the best they can, and I wish them all the best. I'm the chair of ESSAC, and that's why I'm here. Can we get the picture up again? First slide from the beginning. Thank you. Forward and forward. There. So who are ESSAC? ESSAC is the Security and Stability Advisory Committee here in ICANN, and our charter is to advise ICANN board and the community on anything that is security-related, or anything that has to do with the identifiers that we are using. We have created 73 recommendations, 73 documents with various different kind of recommendations so far. Next slide, please. We are 35 members, and our charter that we are to advise ICANN board and community matches the mission and core values of ICANN, which you can see up to the far left if you have very good eyes. to ensure the stable and secure operation of the Internet's unique identifier systems and preserving and enhancing the operational stability, reliability, security, and global interoperability of the Internet. That is what ICANN must do. This is part of ICANN's goal. And then we have our charter is to advise ICANN board and community. So we are the ones that try to ensure that ICANN's community and board is actually following, they're living up to their mission. So that's what we are trying to do. Not always easy. So how do you do this? Well, we come up with these reports, and these reports include some of them recommendations. And some of these recommendations are recommendations to ICANN board, and you see that to the right. That we send advice to the board, and the board then decide either that they have to include that in some kind of policy, they have to inject what we are recommending in the policy development processes. So we might say, you should now think about these and these and these things, and they have to start a PDP. Or it might be the case that it is something that ICANN staff should do better or different, and then the board asks staff to please ensure that you are doing whatever ASAC is proposing. Or it might be the case that we ask ICANN to please talk to the W3C or the CA Browsers Forum or the ITF and then or some other organization, ITU, and then ICANN is doing that. Or the fourth alternative, which is very important, ICANN board makes a decision that, oh, you ESSAC people, yes, you talk about risk, but we are prepared of taking that risk. So we are choosing a different path forward than you suggest. So to take advice into account does not mean that they have to follow our advice all the time. Although they have followed our advice, I think, in all cases except two. One is a little bit older, but one where they did not follow our advice had to do with namespace collision, where they did choose a different path forward than what we choose. We suggested that ICANN should set up a server that actually received traffic to all that was coming to all new TLDs. So it would be possible to analyze where the traffic was coming from. ICANN decided to not do that, but instead forced the registries to delegate all new domain names to 127.0.53.53 and not collect data. The final report from ICANN that explains why they did choose a different track is not published yet. It's not even we know why ICANN did choose a different path. But of course, we in ESSAC, we choose our normal escalation methods when board do not follow our advice, which was we printed T-shirts which said 127.0.53.53 on the back. That's how we escalate. Anyways, we have good cooperation with board, and we had a meeting with ICANN board yesterday evening, so everything is fine and dandy. But it's important to know that there might be other parameters that makes it reasonable for ICANN or anyone else to not follow our advice, but they must take it into account, which is the wording. So, next slide. I think we are... Yeah, good. This is the last thing. What could be interesting is the box down to the right, which is outreach. It's our web page. We have a Facebook page, new for us. Don't really know how to use that. Modern things. And also, we have started to make videos to explain what we are doing, to explain our reports. We are very modern, starting to use video now. Okay, anyways. So, is there anyone that have any sort of questions about ESSAC? Because I have, thanks to Ale, I've got some questions from you that I was thinking of sort of going through here. Nothing special? Okay, shoot. 17 minutes, and then we have the chair of ARSAC, which is already here. Why are you here so early? Okay, he didn't upload. Okay, you can go to Yanis and do that now, because I don't need the screen anymore, so I'm fine. Thank you. Lars-Johan Lehmann, chair of ARSAC, which is sort of a sibling organization to ESSAC. He will talk to you shortly. First question, how does IDN affect the security of the DNS? Well, being the person that came up with IDN, I'm the person that wrote the standard. It's my fault if you think it doesn't work really well. Blame me. Yeah, sorry. Anyways, no, it was me and a couple of other people. So more seriously, IDN do not affect the DNS at all. Because as those of you who work with IDN know, the IDN or the use of Unicode is something that has only happened in the user presentation in the clients. In the presentation layer. because every time an IDN is really in use in DNS, it is first converted to what is called an A label, or only ASCII characters, A to Z, 0 to 9, and dash. And because of that, DNS only see those ASCII characters. And this was actually one of the main reasons why I proposed to have this encoding and not start to pass around Unicode characters in the DNS, because it was too risky to start to use Unicode characters in the DNS software we have out there in the world. So DNS do not use Unicode. Okay. On the other hand, all provisioning software, all web browsers, all email clients, all email servers, everything that supports IDN must support the transformation between what is called a U label and A label. That's where there are problems. That's where there might be sort of bugs. There might be clients that cannot do the transformation. So when you get an email or you see a web page, you still see XM dash dash blah, 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 because it's not transformed from the ASCII that is used in DNS to Unicode. But this choice was made just because, one, it was a little bit risky to start using Unicode in the DNS, even though the DNS protocol theoretically should be able to handle it, but also because there were so many clients that could not handle Unicode, and the most important thing we felt was to be able to do a reply on an email. And that is only possible if it is the case that you just receive the ASCII version. So inside the system, only ASCII is in use.
Hello, sorry. I really want to understand this, but it's a bit hard for me when you use the acronyms. And so if you can repeat this in a more simplified way, I'd love that, please.
Not a question, but also, can you somehow make like examples so that some of those who don't come with a tech background could understand something?
Just a second. Sure. Okay. So if you want to go to a web page which has a domain name with a non-ASCII character in the domain, type in that string in the web browser. The web browser detects that at least one of the characters in one of the tokens of the domain name, where one token is a word between dots. So at least one of them, you have at least one character that is not ASCII. Which is not A to Z, 0 to 9, dash, and a few other characters. What the browser is then doing is convert that into XN, dash, dash, and a couple of other characters. Okay, wait a second. I need my own computer. My own computer, which is not here, it's down there. Okay, anyway. This is a little bit early in the morning. No. I want actually to show explicitly how it works. And I need software that I have on my computer. So let's ignore that now. So what is happening is that the browser is converting that specific token into something which is in without Unicode and only in A to Z and 0 to 9, the letters we use in Western Europe and some other languages in the world. That string is what is used for the DNS lookup. So the string that includes the Unicode character is not what is used in lookup. And that is the string that is used in the URI when the browser is actually fetching whatever resource it is to fetch. So there are a multitude of websites where you can type in Unicode strings and get back this string which do not have Unicode character outside A to Z, 0 to 9. And when a string includes Unicode characters and is a domain name, it's called ULabel. When that string is converted to ASCII only, A to Z, 0 to 9, it's called ALabel, the letter A-label. The new version of internationalized domain name, which we are using nowadays since 2010, has a one-to-one mapping between A labels and U labels. And earlier versions did not have had that ability to map back and forth. So nowadays, if you use more modern software, whether you use a string with the Unicode character or whether you use the XM dash dash version, doesn't matter. A label and U label, nothing else. Unfortunately, the program here at ICANN for universal acceptance, they had in their presentation Monday many other kind of wordings on these kind of things, which is actually a little bit confusing. A label, U label, nothing else. Really important to use the correct terminology. Okay, 10 minutes left. I must move forward. We have to do IDN some other time. Yes, you wanted to add something.
I'm Nabil Ben Amar from Morocco. I'm here as a fellow, returning fellow. And I'm also a member of the Task Force for Arabic Script IDNs. So we have come up with the first proposal from the community, and still have just some comments to update our proposal, final proposal to ICANN. My question is, our items that we will in the timeline is to tackle the second level for the top level domain. So the second level. So we are now working on the top level domain, the Arabic script to be used. The second step will be the second level, and the third step will be the universal acceptance. It means how to deal with email addresses and how to have email addresses with IDNs. What are your suggestions to complete this task?
Well, I think, first of all, ICANN should create a good... Well, as we have said in ESSAC, it's important that ICANN come up with one set of code points and rules for those code points to be used in the root zone. ICANN don't have to do anything else. That is the important thing. What is done in the TLDs are up to the TLD registries. Of course, I can come up with suggestions to help coordinate between the registries, but that's absolutely secondary. And then ICANN should work on universal acceptance. So from my perspective, concentrate on the root zone and then look at the universal acceptance. Second level is not so important, not from an ICANN perspective, because ICANN don't have any policy for the second level. So coordination, yes. That's also why there's a big difference between the root zone and the second level. Email, that's part of the universal acceptance. But that is also not hard, because there are three or four dominant producers of email clients. Just talk to them. So regarding the Arabic script, personally, because of confusion between me and ICANN staff, my own comments on the Arabic and Armenian LDR, Sarmad received that only the day before yesterday. I'm sorry, but there are some issues there. Sarmad got it the 2 days 2 days ago. Excuse me? I don't understand. He said today too. I don't understand that. Anyways, yeah, but I'm not talking about the workshops. I'm saying that I sent in my comments on the Arabic and Armenian LDR proposal 2 days ago only. My apologies. That's what I'm trying to say. So, next question. We have six questions yet. No. I have my questions, and those are the ones I'm going through first. If you still have time, and Lehman has not thrown me away, I will do. Okay, I'll do this fast. What are your ideas about how to encourage ISPs to enable DNSSEC at their site? Do they have to wait for a disaster and then deploy DNSSEC, etc.? And their answer is no, they have not, and they should not wait for a disaster. ISPs, or more importantly, parties that look up domain names on behalf of end users, which often are ISPs, they should and must turn on validation of DNSSEC signed responses. That's what they should do. Before validation exists, people will not sign their zones. So please talk to your ISP, your enterprise, your IT department to turn on validation. It doesn't cost anything. It doesn't cost CPU. There are a lot of rumors out there. Just turn it on. Next question. DNSSEC and then DANE, what is next? That's actually a damn good question. IPv6 deployment, DNSSEC deployment, and DANE deployment is moving slower than a snail. So I talked to Dan York yesterday at ISOC, that is running their Deploy 360 program, and asked him, what will we do? I asked this question to him. When you are done with IPv6, DANE, and DNSSEC, what will you do? He just looked at me like, that will never happen, that we're done with all those things. So we agreed that when IPv6, DNSSEC, and DANE is deployed, we, and also all in this room, can retire. More seriously, we don't really know. But it's so much work to do with DNSSEC and DANE, and DANE is something we need because we cannot use certificate authorities anymore for certificates. It just does not work. Okay, we must use DANE. And for those who don't know, DANE implies that you create your own certificate, place it in your own DNS zone, and you sign your zone with DNSSEC. You do that, and software supports it. You do not have to go to a certificate authority and pay for certificates. You can manage the certificates yourself, the whole idea. Of course, the certificate authorities don't like that because that means that they lose business, but I don't really care. I want a nice world. Next question. Openness means more security needed. Could you share with us your ideas about that? Yes, openness means that we share more information between us, between services. You log into one service and then you use that login when you go to a second service, etc. It implies that these services have a higher responsibility to keep track of your username, your password. The logins needs to be much more secure, and people are not allowed to. It's a stronger responsibility to take care of whatever kind of mechanisms that are used for specific logging in and information about persons. We in ESSA call that credential management or credential lifecycle management. And we are currently working on a report on credential management lifecycle that hopefully will be released in just 2 weeks. So that is something that actually, if whoever was interested, asked this question, there will be a report the next 2 weeks, and we'll present it at the Internet Governance Forum in Brazil. The idea was to have it ready to this meeting, but we just didn't make it. That was a second apology. Sorry. And by the way, in the slide deck that Janis have, there is a presentation on this credential management in that slide deck, some slides that you can have a look at. Next question. 3 minutes. 3 minutes. Yeah. There are various aspects of securing domain names and IP addresses, both for providers and end users. What are your activities for both groups? Well, on the domain name side, we in ESSEC are working with DNSSEC and DANE and namespace collision and various kind of things. On the IP address side, we are following the work that is done with, for example, RPKI, but we don't see the world really agreeing on use of RPKI yet, which is signing of IP addresses and route announcements. So what we are doing on the IP address side is that we are currently started investigating what IP addresses people are using on the internet as compared to what IP addresses are allocated for people on the internet. And there is now, when we have run out of IP addresses, people have started to use IP addresses that are allocated for someone else but not announced. And that is something that we're currently investigating, because that has increased. So if Janis, for example, had got a block of IP addresses from Afrinik and she is not using it, then Lars-Johan Lima might detect that and start using those addresses. Stealing them, yeah. But on the other hand, as long as there is no overlap, as long as not both Janis and Lima uses the addresses, it is sort of okay, although we don't know who is using them. So it ends up being problematic for law enforcement and stuff and things. So what we are doing in the first step is to look at this. The next step, of course, which is worse, is if all IP addresses are not allocated, but if all IP addresses are used. Because I envision, and from an ESSEC envision, that at that point in time, people will start to use IP addresses that others are using as well. That's really bad. And that is, unfortunately, specifically people not living close to the core of the internet in the world, which means that specifically developing countries will probably be the ones that have most issues in those cases. Or northern part of Sweden, for that matter. We're pretty far away. Point in time, we must use IPv6. So IPv4 will probably, I think personally, be more or less unusable within the next 2 years. That means that everything you are installing today that you think that you will use more than 2 years must support IPv6. So even if people like aid organization from Sweden or like whatever, even if people donate things to you and it doesn't support IPv6, do not accept it because it will not help you so much. Of course, it will help for a short period of time, the next year or something. You must be aware and put a special sticker, mark the equipment so you know, or software. I have received this. I did a conscious choice to use it, even though it doesn't support IPv6. Write it down on the list so that you 1 year from now replace it. You cannot use IPv4 much longer than 1 or 2 years. And then the last thing. DNSSEC is a solution that should be utilized by the ISPs to ensure the originality of the domain IP conversation, avoid attacks like DNS poisoning, but how can you help end users to protect themselves against such attacks if their ISP is not protecting themselves by tools like DNSSEC? This is. I already talked a little bit about this. It's actually sort of confuses a little bit the securing the IP address and routing with the domain names. How can you protect yourself? Well, you can use your own resolver. You don't have to use the one that your ISP is using. You can use the Google 8888 resolver that is doing validation of DNSSEC. So you don't have to use the resolver that the ISP is using. It's probably the easiest way. Okay, last question.
Is it secure to use public Google DNS for resolver?
Yes and no. Whenever you have a resolver that you communicate with, the communication between your software and the resolver is unsecure. So you must be sort of certain that that path is trusted, regardless of whether it's between you and the Google resolver or you and the DNS and the resolver of the ISP. The best thing is if you run a resolver on your own computer, of course.
Hi, Manuel from Mexico, for the record. I was wondering, why is ESSEC an AC and not an SO for doing policy?
Because we are not, exactly because what you just said, we don't run a policy development process. We're an advisor to the policy development processes.
But given the fact that what you do is very, very important, shouldn't it be better to make it a policy creation instead of just giving advice that might not be mandatory?
Yeah, no, what we actually think it's much, much better if we have a strong advisor role, which means that we are forcing the policies developed by others to have certain sort of features. So, for example, we were the ones that forced all accredited registries and registrars under the new RIA 2013 and all new DTLD registries to both support IPv6 and DNSSEC. So we were able to influence that policy even though we didn't develop the policy. So that's how we work.
After the transition from IPv4 to IPv6, this
No, it's not a transition. What we're doing is that we are deploying IPv6 while still running IPv4. Then there's a separate step to potentially one day turn off IPv4.
Okay. IPv6 is 128-bit. So the message after DNSSEC signing our zone will be bigger.
That is correct.
This means the MTA of 1,500 will be blocked by firewall at our side.
Well, only... Okay. What he's saying is that the packet size for the DNS response will go over 1,500 bytes. Yes, that might very well be the case. If it is the case that you have a firewall that blocks IP packets that are larger than 1,500 bytes, then you should reconfigure a firewall. Wait. What you have to remember here is that IP packets larger than the MTU size will be fragmented. So the second thing that you're... And the MTU size is normally 1,500 bytes. But you have to differ between the packet size, 1,500 bytes, and the IP packet size, which might be larger. So what you might talk about is that your firewall is blocking fragmented IP packets, which means that even if you have an MTU that is 1,500 bytes or smaller, you can still handle larger IP packets by getting fragments. And yes, there are firewalls that do not handle fragmented IP packets, specifically fragmented UDP packets. And that is a problem. I agree with you there. So the only thing you can do there is, in that case, to watch very carefully how large the packets are when you are signing your zone and choose, for example, the domain names for your records carefully. So compression that can be used for DNS to make the actual each one of the records and the resource record set as small as possible so that, for example, by choosing different naming, you can get smaller packet size.
Hi, my name is Hansa. I'm from Sudan. My first ICANN meeting. So my question is, what is the security issues that can be taken into account when deploying IPv6 within DNS? I mean, due to the differences between the structures of IPv6 and IPv4.
I think when you start deploying IPv6 networks, you should take advantage of the large address size. And for example, IPv6, you are not forced to do subnetting and the topology of your network according to sort of some kind of limitation because you have a very small IPv4 address space. So you can actually, with IPv6, build a network structure, a logical networking structure that matches your needs. And by doing that, you can build a more secure environment where you can control the communication between the various functions in your organization. So that is one of the more important things you can do. Another thing you can do is, of course, that I find it being, for security reasons, a good thing that everything on the network do have globally unique addresses. Some people think that network address translation boxes are a good thing, but I actually think that from an administrative perspective, it is not good with NAT boxes because when you just see an IP address, it's so difficult to keep track of what it is. With IPv6, everything can have its own address, which also increases security.
Yeah, we
need to take the... Give the microphone to Lee.
Good morning.
As well.
My name is Rapid from Cambodia. Usually, when I go to some country, when they block the access to internet, I change to the Google DNS. And as far as you said, that the connection from us to the Google server, it is not secure. Why can ISAC set up its own independent DNS server to make it secure? Or?
Well, if it is the case that you're behind some kind of firewall that are blocking traffic, regardless of whether it is in a state that blocks it or in a company that blocks it, hotels sometimes do all different kind of blocking. Sometimes it's easier to break out of that by having more services on your local computer, so running your own resolver sometimes solves it, so you're on your own DNS server. Sometimes you unfortunately must have a server somewhere in the world and you open a tunnel to that server and you tunnel everything there. There are servers to buy. For example, I have one that I bought in the US, a virtual server that cost me $10 a month. And just by having that one and open an SSH tunnel or a tunnel of HTTP just to that server, and then I tunnel all IP packets to that server. And on top of that tunnel, I can then do whatever I want. So unfortunately, so two ways of getting around these kind of policy things. But we have to remember, there is a reason why there is a policy there. It means that what you are starting to do, what we're talking about now, is violating the policy that someone has applied for some reason. And that is something that you should be conscious of. Given that you would like to try to violate that policy for some reason, and there are multiple reasons for that, I do it all the time, including my own office. You either have more services on your laptop instead of using the ISP, or you have more services on another machine that you control and a tunnel. And you need to have both of these sort of, I'll call it toolboxes, just like a carpenter that carry on the toolboxes. Unfortunately, that is needed. Thank you very much.
I shudder to think of your office. Patrick, thank you. A couple thoughts. One, interpreters, thank you. I know, in the past, trying to tell Patrick to slow down is like trying to step in front of a freight train. So his passion overruns, and I really appreciate your keeping up. Two, one of our fellows, Elsa, mentioned to me yesterday in a download session that we should have a 101, an ICANN for dummies, a newcomer for dummies, because it is really difficult no matter how we try. ICANN Learn, I talked to her about we would get more courses that kind of get to it. And it just, I thought about this with this, because the interest is here, and the level I explained to everyone has to be set around the middle, and I'm challenged, raise my hand. Or this is not challenging enough, raise my hand, and bring it from the middle. But perhaps we can work with you on something that's a, DNSSEC and RSEC for beginners?
Yeah, DNSSEC is easy because, of unfortunately, you missed that session, but we in SSEC always have DNSSEC for beginners on Monday afternoon, which you missed. A little bit more advanced DNSSEC session starts now at 9 o'clock and runs until 2 p.m., I think, a whole day just for DNSSEC. So DNSSEC for beginners we do have, and then maybe we should have, and I do know that the IDN people have similar programs, but not with by us from SSEC.
Thank you very much. And Yunbin, I need to jump up and get your presentations going, so I'll let you introduce yourself while I do so.
So hello, we are now all worn out by the security-related stuff up here, so I have it nearby if I need it. Thank you, Patrick. Patrick is an old, long-time friend of mine, and it so actually happens that we work for the same company. I'm Lars Johan Liman. I'm one of the two co-chairs of the Root Server System Advisory Committee, and I was instructed to forward my second co-chair, Tripti Sinha's regrets that she couldn't be here. She unfortunately has to leave this morning because she has an important family event to attend back in the United States. actually, her niece is getting married, so she has a wedding to attend. But I'm here. I will try to tell you some things about the Root Server System Advisory Committee and what we do and what we're here for and what's going on now. So, next slide, please. Can I see the slide somewhere? I can hear, I suppose. Yes. So, what's RSAC? Well, the Root Server System, as you probably know, is the entry point to the DNS system. When you want to look something up and you have no idea where to start, the Root Servers is where you start. There is 13 IPv4 addresses and, I believe, 11 IPv6 addresses that you can send your query to get into the DNS system and get referrals so that you can walk your way down through the system and eventually obtain the information you're looking for. The Root Server System Advisory Committee is another advisory committee within ICANN. As Patrick said, we're a sibling organization, but our scope is very, very narrow. So what we do is to advise the ICANN community and the ICANN board on matters relating to the operation, administration, security, and integrity of the Internet's root server system. That's very narrow. We only care about the root servers and the root zone, which is the data that we provide from the root servers. I should mention that I work for NetNode, and NetNode operates one of the root servers. They are denoted by letters, so we have a.rootservers.net, B, C, D, and in my case, I operate i.rootservers.net together with the NetNode staff. What we do from these root servers, which are ordinary DNS servers, there is nothing strange with a root name server. We use exactly the same hardware, exactly the same operating systems, exactly the same software for providing DNS service, and exactly the same type of data in the databases as any TLD or any operation or any association that runs its own DNS service. There's no magic. The only thing is that we happen to sit on the IP addresses that are the entry point to the system. So we care about the root zone, which is the zone file, the list of DNS records that we provide from the root servers. We need to have that copied into the machines, and we receive it from the root server operators receive that from the IANA, which is operated by ICANN, and then through a process where it's approved by the NTIA, which is a subdivision of the US government, and then actually commissioned by the company VeriSign, because that's how it's all set up. So NetNode gets the information from VeriSign. So the entire process of making sure that the data is okay all the way from when it's generated at the IANA until it reaches the root server that sits on the network and provides the answer, that path is where what RSAC cares about. And we communicate on matters relating to the operation of the root servers, and we do that a lot with the technical community, because what we worry about is the stability of the system and the resilience and the reachability. Our first and foremost priority is to make sure you get answers when you ask a root name server. And you should get the correct answer as long as that's possible. As Patrick mentioned, when you send a packet across the internet, you have no idea how it travels. But I can promise from NetNode's side, and then if your packet reaches us, we respond with the correct information as we receive it from VeriSign. And when we send the packet out with the response, it's okay. Someone may change this on the pack as the packet goes back towards you. We cannot do anything about that. But when it leaves us, it's okay. And if you ask for it, it's signed with DNSSEC. This is a flag in the query. You can say, I want DNSSEC or I don't want DNSSEC. But if you do set that flag, it's signed and you can verify the content. We also communicate on the administration of the root zone. We analyze and keep track of things like the data bits in the zone file. There are more things than just domain names. There are time to lives. There are delegation information, and stuff like that. And we try to keep an eye on how all these things are tied together so that it will function in a stable and good way. Next slide, please. We also engage in threat assessment. The root server system is a target for various types of attacks. I will not deny that. And we constantly monitor the system. The root server operators monitor, and we talk about that in RSAC and also in other constellations. We also respond to requests for information or advice from the board. So later today in this room, RSAC and the board will have a joint meeting where we will inform the board and respond to some queries, and also I believe, I shouldn't say that. At least it's an open meeting, so you're welcome to attend. We also make policy recommendations to the ICANN community and to the board, much in the same way as SSAC. If we see that a supporting organization is developing a policy that may have a bad effect on the root servers, maybe they're trying to construct something that will have a very sudden impact on the service, then it's difficult for the root server operators to predict how that will affect the service. So we may forward a recommendation saying, don't do this very quickly, do it slowly so that we can follow the system and see that it continues to operate correctly. We also report periodically to the ICANN community. This is one way of doing it, but we also have open RSAC meetings. They are usually quite short and boring, but you're still very welcome to attend. Next slide, please. We participate as one of the advisory committees. So we have two members participating in the ICG panel for the IANA transition. The NTIA stewardship transition for the IANA. We do participate to some extent in the accountability discussions, although as we've been thinking about that, we've realized that RSAC doesn't have much of a stake in that in those discussions. General multi-stakeholder discussions. We also have liaisons to the ICANN board and to the NOMCOM, so we have ICANN representatives on the board, one representative on the board and one in NOMCOM. These are non-voting members, but at least they can convey information both ways and inform and give advice as necessary. Next slide, please. So how is RSAC constructed? It's composed of appointed member from the 12 organizations that operate root name servers. I said there were 13 addresses, so there's a mismatch there because one of the organizations actually operates two servers, two letters. So there are 12 organizations. We also have liaisons, as I mentioned, to the board and NOMCOM, but we also have incoming liaisons from the three parties that are involved in generating the root zone. So that means the IANA, the NTIA, Department of Commerce, US, and VeriSign, who does the actual editing and putting it on the servers. So we have them involved as well, and we also have a liaison to the Internet Architecture Board, which is the technical side, the IETF and the IEB constitute the technical development and of standards and operations. And in addition to that, we also have something we call the ARSAC Caucus. This is a large pool of various types of experts and people who can contribute with their knowledge and experience, because we're a very, very small group and we don't have all the experience and knowledge that we need to do the investigations and produce the documents that we see the need for. So we rely on more people to help us do the right thing, find what we need to look at, conduct the investigations, help us write the documents, and we interact very closely with the caucus so that we get a good feeling of that, and that we have the antennas out there so that we can kind of more input and also generate more output. So it's the caucus is very important to us. Procedures. So ARSAC, the formal committee, has a rather narrow or a rather small task. Most of the interesting work is conducted in the caucus. But ARSAC is the administrative body that selects the work items so that we can prioritize and say this is the most important thing that we need to work on right now, or maybe a few ones in parallel. And we appoint work parties in the caucus. We ask for someone to lead the work on creating a document or conducting an investigation. And then they will invite other people to join them and report back when there are results to report back to the ARSAC. And ARSAC will then take formal action, which is usually decide to publish a document or to give advice or make a statement or something like that. The formal committee meets at ICANN meetings like this. We will have a continued meeting later today. We were in meeting all in session all day yesterday, and we also have regular telephone conferences. So every month we have teleconferences where we forward our work and continue. Yes, we also do boring administrative stuff like appoint liaisons and elect chairs and create the actual procedures and processes we use when we work. So we have one document that describes how do we conduct our work. And that's our actually very first document, ARSAC 000. ARSAC was a very, very small and slowly functioning body, and it didn't used to meet at ICANN before, because most of the people of the old ARSAC were engineers that didn't attend ICANN meetings, because this is mostly a policy-related meeting. So ARSAC used to meet at the IETF meetings, which are the standardization body where the engineers typically go. So the engineers were at the IETF, so that's where the meetings were conducted. Over the past 3-4 years, we have reshaped ARSAC into a new model, which is the one I described here. And we've also realized that we need to be closer to the ICANN community, and therefore we have moved our meetings from the IETFs to the ICANN meetings, and we now meet regularly here. As I said, we have two co-chairs. It's myself and Tripti Sinha, Tripti, who unfortunately couldn't be here today. And the caucus, well, we talked about that mostly. The caucus also creates transparency. The caucus is very open. Anyone who wants to join the caucus is welcome to apply at least, and we haven't turned anyone down yet. And that means that since the work is created there and the mailing list is open for the caucus, that's where the transparency happens, where people can see what ARSAC works with and how it proceeds. But it's actually transparency both ways, because in order to join the caucus, you have to give a formal statement of interest. You have to say, why do I want to join the caucus, and with whom am I affiliated? Whom do I work for? Where's my very short version of my CV? So, and then on the documents that are published, we always list the names of the people involved in creating the document. So someone who reads the document can see, oh, Lars-Johan Lehmann was there writing this document. Let's go to his statement of interest, and they are published on the web. You can look them up on the ARSAC pages. Oh, Lars-Johan Lehmann, he works for NetNode. Okay, I wonder how that influenced his work with this document, and then you can make your own judgment about that. So that creates another building block in the transparency that we try to create. Next slide, please. The caucus members are, all members of RSAC are also member of the caucus, but that's just a small part. So the bigger part is people that that have applied and people that we have invited to the caucus. Next slide, please. Yes, there's. We talked about most of this. When the caucus receives a clear work statement, we always write a document and say, this is what we would like you to do this time. And we ask for a document leader to volunteer. There are the usual timelines and expected outputs and so on. But another important point here is the last bullet, which means that if you have a work party caucus who creates a document, and there are people who really disagree with the content, that must be listed in the document. So there, if there is such disagreement, there will be a section in the document saying the following people disagreed with the following statement for the following reason. So it's also a way to create transparency around the fact that that people weren't agreeing, that there was no unanimity. Even though we only have rough consensus, we can still want to give an advice, but then we also include the fact that other agree and hopefully the reason for doing so. The caucus membership committee is a small subcommittee which only does the administrative tasks of receiving the applications, making sure that there is a statement of interest and so on, and then eventually forwarding the names to RSAC for formal approval. And as I said, we haven't denied anyone. The membership committee is three people. It's Kavi Ranjbar, who works for the RIPE NCC and operating K-Route. It's Tripti, and it's also Paul Vixie from C-Route. And they have a staggered rotating system, so we will eventually slowly rotate them. Now, these slides are the coming slides are usually presented by Tripti in her role as in the membership committee. So we'll just go through them quickly. So the membership committee maintains a continuous stream of membership to the caucus. And kind of manages the membership. If someone wants to quit and leave, that's, of course, not a problem. But we need to keep track of who is actually in the caucus. And they also update the RSAC, the formal committee, about what's going on. I think we've gone through most of this. The actual process for getting into the caucus is to send a message to RSAC-membership at icann.org. The membership committee will go through these statements. They will make sure that there is a statement of interest. They will inform the candidates about the process and what's going on. And the memberships committee meets every other month. Sorry, so there's 2 months between their telephone meetings, and then they work through the applications. If someone hears about ongoing work in RSAC and says, oh, I want to contribute, I want to help with that specific issue that you are already working with, there is an expedited version so that we can get people in quicker than the two-month cycle, if necessary. And if you want more information, please, again, send messages to RSAC membership. And there is also a document which describes how we interact with the caucus and how the caucus works. Moving from the caucus to what we're actually doing in RSAC and have done recently. So RSAC has a series of documents. It's rather short so far because the old version meeting at the IETFs didn't produce many documents and they were not numbered. So the process of creating documents wasn't very clear. We did change that, so now we have a very clear process for producing documents. And apart from the 000 that I mentioned, which is internal, describing our procedures, we have one which is ready for publication but isn't published yet, called RSAC 001, which It's called service expectation. Now, if I remember correctly, I'm actually going through these on the following slide. So RSAC 002 is published. It's an advisory on measurements of the root service system, and RSAC 003 is a report on the time to live values in the root zone and how they relate to DNS sex signatures and so on. And we also have created various statements, for instance, on the signature validity period, and also statements on the, you know, two work parties. We have one work party which is working right now, and we've realized that the names of the root name servers, as I mentioned, they're denoted by letters, a.rootservers.net, these are domain names, and you can look up the IP addresses for these using normal DNS. The names have been in use for more than 20 years now, and the change from the previous naming scheme, which was very non-deterministic, they just had ordinary computer names, that change was made in order to take advantage of the compression algorithm in the packets. And we now have names which are not in the root zone. You have to go through net and then into rootservers.net in order to reach the records that deliver the IP addresses for the rootname servers. So one thing we're looking at is trying to rename the servers so that they will instead live in the root zone and be contained in the root zone information. That together with several other aspects of the naming is being investigated by this work, and they have been tasked to come with a recommendation whether to change the names or not, and if to change it to. We're also about to launch a small, probably not a work party, but we found already in one of the documents that there was a technical error where the document RSAC 002 recommends a number of measurements that the root server operators should take, so they should measure the system and to do it in the same way so that we can compare the numbers between the various operators. And in one of the cases, it turns out that the numbers are kind of skewed when you measure UDP packets, the single queries, TCP packets where you have a stream of information going through more packets. It's just a small technical detail, so we will probably not launch an entire work party around that. We will talk to the caucus, we will ask for comments from the caucus for making this errata change to the document. How are we doing on time? Okay. So RSAC 001 is a document that's intended to describe the expectations that the internet community should have on root servers. What should you expect from a root server? What do we intend to deliver to you? That document is going to be published in parallel at the same time as a document from the IETF side. It's published by the IAB, the Internet Architecture Board. There are older documents that describe root server and root service expectations. They were all in the RFC series from the IETF. But when we realized that the newest one of those is more than 10 years old, and things have changed on the network, as you may have noted. When we sat down and started to talk about writing a new revision of that document, we realized that actually it contains both requirements on the DNS protocol. So which parts of the DNS protocol should we expect that a root server can handle? But it also had operational requirements, saying things about capacity, about network connectivity, and these are things that are not directly related to the quality, the protocol side. So we decided to divide the document in two separate ones, where the Internet Architecture Board is the right body to set the requirements for the protocol. They are responsible for, so to speak, the DNS protocol, so they can set the requirements for what should the root server do from a quality. Then we had to find another body to deal with the operational side, and actually there is none obvious. You could think of something like the NANOG, the North American Network Operators Group, but again, they have counterparts in all parts of the world, so there's no single international body for that. But then we thought of RSAC, realizing that, this is probably a good place where we can put operational requirements on the root servers and have that published. But we want these two documents to go out at the same time because they refer to each other and they are actually a pair of documents that are tied together even though they are published by different bodies. And we're still waiting for that RFC. It used to be my fault. It's for the moment not my fault. And I hope to get it out really, really soon because it's actually written and we only need to have an okay from the few people that have asked for a few changes to it. Next slide. So RSEC 001 is the operational side, and it talks about the infrastructure around the root servers, the accuracy and availability of the service, capacity. Diversity is a very important thing, because the root server operators all make their own decisions about how to provide a service, and that's our best strength, because I decide, together with the NetNode staff, we may decide to operate in one way, and Internet Systems Consortium, who operate FRoot, they may decide something completely different. And again, University of Maryland, DRoot, will take a totally different approach to how to do it. The important thing is that you get the correct answer. The important thing is not how we do to make sure we get the correct answer. And by doing it differently, we are not vulnerable to a single type of attack. If we all used a special version of Linux, and that Linux version was attacked in a special way, had a vulnerability, we would all go away at the same time. We don't, because we use one version of Linux, and maybe they use Oracle Solaris on one site, and they use IBM servers on another site. So that diversity is very important in the root server system, and we don't want to have a single organization take care of it, because they will not create the same diversity. And the document also talks about monitoring and measurements and about how to be public about what we do. That, it turns out to be a rather problematic thing, because reaching out to people when people don't know where to look for information is actually a hard problem. RSEC 002 kind of ties into the RSEC 001 because this document specifies the measurements that the root server operators are expected to do on their systems. And it's simple things like counting the number of queries per second and looking at the number of clients. We don't care who they are, just how many clients do we have to our systems. This was all triggered by the new GTLD system, the GTLD program. When ICANN opened up for new top-level domains, we were starting to add top-level domains to the root zone in a much higher pace. Before the GTLD program changes to the root zone, additions of new top-level domains happened, every 2 years, 3 years? Now we have 5 per week, or 10 per week. So the change, the rate of change got a lot steeper, and this is a new thing for the root servers and the root server operators. We want to have to monitor the systems carefully and to do so over a long time. We can see trends and we can see when things start to happen, and if there are problems with the system, we want to be prepared to before now and see how we can fix the problems. So far we have seen no problem whatsoever, none, nothing. We do see constant change, the number of queries slowly increase, but that's the general trend on the internet, and it's been like that for the past 25 years, so that's not a worry. We also see certain attacks going on from time to time. That's also no news. That happened before the GTLD program, and it happens after, and there's no actual change to that pattern. So I don't say that the attacks are not a problem, because, of course, attacks are always a problem, but it's a problem that we can handle, at least as they're going on now. And there's no news there. So RSEC 002 is helping us to do this and compare the numbers. Next slide, please. So, as I mentioned, number of queries, also some latency in the system. We receive the zone file from VeriSign. We have to copy that to, in our case, Stockholm, Sweden. We have to copy that out to all our instances of iRoot. And there are more than 50 across the entire globe. We have servers in New Zealand, in Singapore, in Tokyo, in Beijing. We have servers in Mumbai. We have servers in Johannesburg, in South America, North America, Europe. And we have to copy that file from Stockholm to all these servers. From the moment we receive a notification from VeriSign that there's a new version of the zone file, In our case, until all the servers for iRoot are updated, that's usually below 7 seconds. That's one measurement that we have here. How long does it take to propagate the zone file to all the servers? And there are a number of other DNS measurements that we kind of keep track of for statistics and that we can go back and look at. We need to compare the numbers. Next slide, please. So this is just to give you a picture of what the statistics can look like. This is from the public page for KRoot, operated from the RIPE-NCC in Amsterdam. And these are... This is probably a bit old. Yeah, you say it's from 2014. But it still looks roughly like this. These are their servers, and the colors are the various servers across the globe. And they add them together so that you get the total number of queries. And you can see that at the bottom, the servers at AMSIX in Amsterdam, DNIC in Frankfurt, I suppose, and Lynx in London. NAP is probably... I'm guessing now, it's probably the NAP of the Americas in Miami. Those are their big servers, also Tokyo, and then you have a lot of small servers on top of that. And there is more information to obtain about the root servers. We maintain a joint web page. Now, this is not RSAC, this is the root server operators, because we try to maintain the difference. RSAC is the advisory body to ICANN. The root server operators is the group of organizations that provide the service. And for truly operational stuff, you have to talk to the root server operators. To find them, you go to www.rootservers.org, as it says at the top up there, and you will find a map of where, a combined map, that where all the organizations work together to indicate where we have placed our servers. So you can see where they are placed across the entire globe. And you will note that many cities have a couple of servers operated by different operators. I was going to finish there. Oh, my. This is the fun part. Can someone please help me with... Yes, please, Mike.
Thank you. I'm Zizit Kabir from Bangladesh, first timer in ICANN as a fellow. Like to know a few things. Like I saw... RSAC reports of root server TTLs. So it is the root server's bilateral agreement with any party to set any cast host over there, any cast root server over there, like in a country. But you are actually giving reports to some organization about the availability of root servers around the world. Do you have any policy to give the root server organizers or maintainers that, look, your servers or your acquisitions are not available this part of the area, so can you place one or something? Do you have any policy like that? I have another technical questions after this.
Okay, we'll take that one first. To begin with, there are different TTLs involved here. There is the time to live for the DNS records. That's what I was talking about before. Yes. But there's also the response time. You're probably thinking maybe about the TTL and the IP packets. That's a different type of TTL. And that can indicate the response time. How long does it take for the client to get a response from the root server? And that's an important property. But the root server operators, the 12 organizations, deploy servers according to their own policies. So there's not a common policy for all root server operators. So each and every one of them have different policies, and the only one I can speak for is for NetNode. And in our case, we definitely try to find information about where it's problematic to reach our servers. When we do that, we try to take into account whether it's possible to reach another operator's service. So if I'm taking a country out of the blue, Uganda, if it's difficult to reach our server in Uganda, but Uganda has F root, B root, and D root, then it doesn't make sense for us to place a server in Uganda because they're already taken care of by the others. So that's another thing we look at. So try to identify areas where... it's difficult to reach any root server. That's not the only thing that influences our selection, because there are other things that are very important. Is there a good place to put a root server? If we can easily detect that it's very difficult to reach any root server from the Antarctic, from the South Pole. But it doesn't really make sense to put a root server on the South Pole, because there are not many users there. There's probably not a data center where we can put the servers. There's no one there that can help us manage the computer when we need to have it reset or change a hard drive. So there are, and there's no one who's willing to pay for it. So there are many other things that influence the selection of these Anycast sites, and every root server operator has their own policy for how to do that. And I would argue that most of the operators very much welcome initiatives from communities to deploy root servers. I certainly know that we do. So if you feel that the root service doesn't work well for you in your region, please come and talk to me. I will not promise that we actually do place a server near you, but I very much would like to know place so that we can put it on the list of sites that we take into account when we deploy.
Hello, I am Esteban from Argentina, and my question is about which is the difference between root servers and mirror root servers. Because as far as I know, there are 13 original or main root servers, and the others are mirror root servers.
Let me now kill a myth. There are no mirror root servers. Please do not use that term. They do not exist. There are root servers. They are all alike. They all function in exactly the same way. And the thing that may confuse you into believing servers and mirrors is that you say there's only 13 IP addresses talking IPv4. And that is correct, but we cheat. We play tricks on you. The trick we play is that we use a technology called Anycast. And iroot is only one IPv4 address. It used to be, if you go back 15 years in time, we had one server in Stockholm on that specific IP address before we were using Anycast. Today, we have more than 50 servers with the same IP address. Our server in Perth in Australia has the same IP address as our server in Japan, and the same as the server in San Francisco, and the same as the server in Miami. They all have the same IP address. So when you talk to iroot, by using that IP address, you get to the nearest one, the nearest copy. So they all are identical. They all have the same information, the same IP address, the same everything. And the routing system that carries the packets on the network will forward the packet to the nearest one. Now, nearest is a kind of a strange denotation here. It's because the routers decide what near is, but it's well defined. In the routing system, there is an algorithm that says to send it this way. And that's taken care of by the border gateway protocol, the BGP system for sending packets. So there is no difference, because there's no difference to describe, because they are all identical. And there is, on all these servers have the same IP address. So how can we from Stockholm reach the one in Perth? Should just go to the Stockholm one in our case. So they actually, every of these server machines have two addresses. It has one which is the same on every place, and then it has one in the rear which is unique for every site. And that unique address is what we use to update the server with the correct information, and then we can reach them all because they have their unique addresses. So please, all are the same for iroot, all are the same for droot, all are the same for froot. I'm happy to talk afterwards.
Okay, my name is Manuel from NIC Mexico. I was wondering, why has it ever been 13 root servers? Is that like a convention, or is that like history, or
actually,
could you elaborate there?
Actually, technology. If you go back in time, you have to remember that the root server system is very old. It was started to be deployed in the 1980s, around 1982 or 83, 84, and that's when the DNS standard was created, the protocol specification. Now, the internet 30 years ago was something completely different from what we have today. And one of the things they worried about was the size of the packets. So the old DNS standard, which is still the standard in use, specifies that packets may not be bigger than 512 bytes, 512 characters. Now, one of the most important DNS queries you can send is to ask for the list of root servers. What is the current list of root servers? And in order to fit in that 512 bytes, there's not room for more than 13. And that was actually the reason for renaming from the old names to the rootservice.net, because by taking advantage of the compression, we could make room for a few more. We went from 913 by just renaming them. So that's the old limitation. Now you can argue that on the modern internet we have new extensions to the DNS protocol, EDNS, extended DNS, which most servers use, where you can use larger packets. The limitation, we want to be very, very, very secure that everyone can reach the information. So we have decided to, I'm sorry, we haven't decided. There has been no decision to extend that beyond the current system. Another reason is that the obvious process for extending was Mr. John Postel. He's unfortunately passed away in 1998. And currently there is no process for changing the root server system. So those who operated the servers in 1998 are still operating the servers now. What we do is instead to use any cost to try to cover as large parts of the globe as we can.
Rahul Sharma from India. So as you mentioned that as of now there is no technology limitation that the number of root server instances or the letters can be increased. So is there any proposal to be submitted by RSSAC or is any discussion going on, especially in the context of INA stewardship transition? Second question.
I am aware of a lot of pressure for creating more servers. I will phrase it like this. If more root server operators should be added, it should be done so for the correct reasons. It should be done so because there are problems to solve, and the problems should be taken. If adding another organization operating root server solves a technical problem, then we should look into it.
And I hate to say it's over because I know you've got a lot of questions. So all I can say is if you're free, I know you have a 10 o'clock, it's up to you, and then you can follow outside so that they can prepare for the next session and ask away if you are free.
Yes, I am free for another, say, half hour because RSAC is meeting with the board later on here. And I'm happy to take questions. And also in the presentation that you will send by email to, mm-hmm. to all of you, my email address is in there, I believe. Mm-hmm. Otherwise,
I share it
Janice
freely.
Has it. I'm happy to take questions over email. Please stop me in the hallway if you see me. I like to interact. This is actually the best session on all I can because you have so many good questions. The other ones, they don't ask. They just plow on. But you want to know. That's good.
Well, I'm going to say thank you very much first. And anyone who would like to follow Lehman out, you are more than welcome to because he's just offered you another half an hour of good discussion. There's some tables outside, so I know you can find a place to set up so that they can get prepared here for the next session. There is a sign-up sheet going around, so before you exit stage left with Lehman, please make sure you've done the sign-up sheet. And Liffey B at 5:30 for the nominating committee and some other speakers, security and somebody else at 30. Can't remember who. Martin, quickly, you wanted to say?
Yes, that MPOC is organizing two informal outbreaks, talks, informal talks, today and tomorrow. The first one today is in the fifth, both days is in the fifth floor in the hall. The topic for today is we are trying to create a clearinghouse for NGOs, so NGOs can have legal consulting for free or a minimum cost, basically to help them to how to protect their name on the internet or how to protect from abuse, and those sorts of things. And tomorrow, what does DNS if the DNS has anything to offer to the migrants and refugees? So in case you want, it's from 12:30 to 130, but it's completely informal. It's actually something we are trying. So whoever wants to come, you're welcome.
And once again, thank you.
And thank you all.
So again, you can follow out as long as you've just done the sign-up sheet, and I'll see you at 5:30. Thank you.